From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. He has been in the White House just a few days, but already President Barack Obama is reversing some of his predecessor's executive orders, and New York Governor David Patterson picks a congresswoman from upstate New York to fill Hillary Clinton's Senate seat. To go over the week's top headlines, we turn to our reporters roundtable. Joining us today, Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Sharice Jones, a national correspondent for USA Today. Clarence, Sharice, welcome.
Hi, Tony.
Thanks.
Let's begin with this. Clarence, you were in D.C. for the event. Chief Justice John Roberts flubbed the oath, we know, the first time, and Mr. Obama repeated the flawed text. So they did a do-over without a Bible in the White House out of, quote, an abundance of caution. But here's the issue. Only a few print reporters were invited to the do-over, and some of the members of the press not so happy about that. Was that a mistake?
Well, it's part of the getting to know you process between the new president and the White House press corps. The press corps, of course, we are always upset when we are left out of any particular proceeding. And so the reporters were pushing back, saying, look, there's no reason why we can't all be in on something like this. There's plenty of room, plenty of precedent for it. So I think that's all part of the process here right now. And they probably will loosen up, especially because this administration stresses transparency so much.
Well, we'll find out for sure. Sharice, you know, one of President Obama's first actions was to block all executive orders made by former President George Bush that had not yet become official. The blocked orders deal with everything from emission regulations to food labeling requirements and the sort. But this was to be expected, wasn't it?
You know, absolutely. I mean, I think that President Obama is trying to put out the message that there is a new sheriff in town. And he ran on, you know, a campaign theme of change and the fact that he was going to be very different from George Bush. And so he came out swinging. You know, he doesn't agree with a lot of the positions the Bush administration took. And so right out the door, he decided to pass ethics reforms, you know, put a freeze on these orders that Bush had put out, and basically say we're going to do things differently now that he's there.
Now, today it was announced that Mr. Obama will sign an executive order that will end a ban on federal funds going to international groups that perform or that promote abortion. Many conservatives support this ban. Clarence, what does this signal about Obama's position on this issue?
On this issue, he's falling in line with the traditional Democratic Party position. Bill Clinton opposed gag rules. George Bush, both Bushes, favor gag rules that prevent any money, any federal dollars, going to aid countries that in turn fund abortion. This is one of those defining issues like affirmative action and Supreme Court picks that really differentiate the parties on values.
Now, Sharice, it's only been a few days, but are we seeing Obama's administration change with a capital C or change with a small c?
I think we're seeing change with a capital C. I mean, just the fact that he has frozen the salaries of senior White House staff and basically said that once you leave his administration, you will not be able to lobby your former coworkers for the duration of his time in office, which could be 8 years, is a significant change from an administration that many saw as being secretive, imperial, out of touch with the American public, an administration that seemed to really favor the privileged and the wealthy as opposed to the common ordinary person. And so I think that the break with what we had just a few days ago in the White House could not be more stark or extreme.
Let's move on to the economy. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress could have an economic stimulus package ready for the White House by mid-February. But listening to GOP leaders like John Boehner and Mitch McConnell just today, Clarence, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, they're pushing back now to show that they're not just going to get walked over by this administration. I think the House has already pretty much shown that they're going to approve the package. The Senate will, but only after arguing, because the Senate's got more ways for each senator to put brakes on the process. There's also Boehner, the House Republican leader, indicated that he was somewhat miffed by Barack Obama's inauguration speech, and it's somewhat confrontational tone. Now, that's arguable, but nevertheless, they're sounding like their feelings are hurt. They said, we want to work with this administration, but they want to do blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of that going back and forth. But, you know, the train's out of the station right now. The Republicans don't want to appear to be obstructionists, and the country has signaled that they're putting their faith for now in Barack Obama and his plans to stimulate the economy.
Now, Timothy Geithner's nomination as Treasury Secretary is moving along slower than Obama must have wanted, I would say. How important is it, Charisse, that he be confirmed soon, given the deteriorating situation with the economy?
You know, I think that the pushback that Tim Geithner is getting, I mean, obviously, if you're going to be the head of the Treasury Department and you didn't handle your own personal financial business very well, that sends a discordant note out to the masses. But I think the fact remains that in the end, they're going to go ahead and do this. They had to point out that he hadn't paid his payroll taxes and that this was an issue to show that they weren't going to just roll over and accept every person that Barack Obama wanted without any questions. But the bottom line is they want the president to have the person in that position that he wants. And he's considered very capable and competent. And we are in such trouble in this country economically that nobody, Republican or Democrat, wants to block someone who they think can actually do an effective job of turning it around.
Let's go back to the stimulus package one more time, Clarence. The issue seems not to be whether to have a stimulus package. The issue seems to be how much money to attach to it, correct?
Well, yeah, and don't ask me how much they're going to finally attach. I think the issue from the Washington point of view is not how much money, but how many votes can you get? Initially, Democrats were talking about getting 80 votes in the Senate. Now they're talking about 60. So what does that tell you? That tells you they're not going to get as much money through as they wanted initially.
All right, let's talk about foreign policy. Perhaps Obama's boldest move so far was to sign the executive order closing Guantanamo, but that creates other challenges, like what to do with the 240-plus detainees being held there. Even the Democrats aren't in complete agreement on what to do, are they, Charisse?
They're not. And President Obama has talked about putting together kind of an advisory team that'll include the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and others to try and sort out the thicket of Guantanamo. Because, you know, clearly you've got people that are in that prison who are too dangerous to release. But if you try them in a courtroom in the United States, they might reveal information that you don't want the public to know. Countries elsewhere may not want to take these inmates. So, you know, it remains a quandary about what you're going to do with these folks. But Guantanamo was really a stain on this country around the world. It really undermined the kind of ideals that we propagate, that we say that we stand for in terms of, you know, the torture that went on and the types of abuses that happened. And so it's an action that he said he was going to take and he had to take. But they're going to have to work out the details of what to do with the folks that are there.
You know, there are those, Clarence, who say that as long as we are in a war footing, which we are definitely in, that places like Guantanamo have to be kept because of the people that you need to capture and put in places like Guantanamo.
Well, Barack Obama has completely refuted that position. It's very significant that this is the first major step he's taken right after right after his inauguration. That tells me that he is making it very clear. Look, don't bother me with the details right now. This is policy. By the end of this year, the place is going to be closed one way or the other. That's what he's saying. And this sends a signal around the world. I mean, right now, this country does not believe in preventive detentions. Our Constitution doesn't believe in it. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, but that was for the extent of a specific war, and he got away with it barely. Barack Obama is taking a very firm position here, and I think in the long run, he will be rewarded for it, unless, say, we have another terrorist attack and the debate possibly shifts against him. Nevertheless, I think that holding that fear over people's heads is the kind of presidential policy that this administration is firmly against.
Would you say, Charisse, that so far at least, and it's very early, I know, that the president has had what might be described as a balanced attack, both in terms of his domestic and foreign policy agenda early on?
Well, I think so. I mean, he began the domestic agenda conversation before he was elected because the crisis was so great in terms of the economy. And he was criticized by a lot of people, particularly those who were concerned about the Palestinians in Gaza, that he wasn't saying enough about it before he actually assumed office. And so the fact that in his first week he called the leaders of Israel and Egypt and the Palestinian Authority in Jordan, that he's closing Guantanamo or saying that he's going to close it within the year, et cetera, shows that, you know, this is a president that understands that we're not an isolated country, that there are a lot of things going on in the world that we have to take a position on, and he's ready to do it at the same time he tries to right our economy.
Now, Obama has also called for the withdrawal of combat troops in Iraq over the next 16 months, but in the meantime, reports are saying that missiles have been fired from a suspected U.S. spy plane that killed 10 in Pakistan. There's disagreement about a troop buildup in Afghanistan. Envoy Richard Holbrook was just named to the region. I'm going to ask you both to think about whether or not this is going according to plan or are we winging it, but I want you to hold on to your thought. We're going to take a break and we will come back in just a few moments. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back with our Reporters Roundtable. With us today, Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Cherise Jones, national correspondent for USA Today. Before the break, folks, I was asking you to think about whether or not the foreign policy as it relates so far to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq, are we winging it or are we going according to plan with the new Obama administration, Clarence?
Well, through the campaign, we saw certain things were clear, that we are moving toward a consensus on what to do about Iraq. Both McCain and Obama weren't that far apart. It was just a question of the timetable. Same thing with Afghanistan. Both agreed we need more troops in Afghanistan. And same thing with Pakistan. Everybody agrees it is unstable. And in recent weeks, we have seen more of these cross-border battles where the U.S. has been firing over there, or we've had back and forth gunfire between Pakistan troops and our own. The Taliban is still a big question mark, but they're growing. They're becoming more of a force to reckon with. We've known all this. It's just that, interestingly enough, Tony, it's been kind of squeezed off the front page by interesting news here from Sarah Palin to you name it.
Well, actually, one of the people who has pushed that story off the headlines, Cherise, is Caroline Kennedy. She will not be replacing Hillary in the Senate. New York Governor David Paterson appointing Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand, described as an upstate conservative Democrat loved by both the NRA and the ACLU. You, which is no easy feat. So what happened, Carolyn? Did Paterson bungle this or did Caroline?
You know, I don't think that either one of them handled it very well. You know, Caroline Kennedy, when she first said she wanted this seat, you know, was swathed in romance and glamour. You know, the heiress to Camelot trying to take over the Senate seat left vacant by her slain uncle. And, you know, people were really caught up in it. But it was a very awkward entry into the political sphere. She was not speaking to reporters, answering their questions. When she did answer, she was not always very articulate about why she wanted to suddenly be in politics after being such a private person. And then there was talk about her not wanting to reveal her financial records, et cetera. So it just seemed that she wasn't very comfortable in the spotlight. And then the governor seemed to play kind of coy. You know, he had this 28-page questionnaire that he wanted everybody to fill out, and he was still looking, and she has pluses and minuses. And then all these rumors would come out that he had already made up his mind and it was going to be her. So I don't think either one of them really emerged looking too good in this process. And she may have just said, you know, I don't need this. You know, I've got, you know, my uncle is ill. I don't want to reveal all my business. And I'll just go back to being a private citizen and do my good deeds behind the scenes.
I would imagine Gillibrand is not likely to be treated the same way Roland Burris was by the Senate. Would you say, Clarence?
No, well, obviously, New York's governor isn't currently on the verge of indictment or impeachment, as ours is. Well, actually, ours has been impeached by the House, of being about to be tried by the Senate. Makes a big difference. And nor were there the very interesting quotes from court-ordered wiretaps of the governor referring to this appointment process as kind of a gold mine of potential campaign donations, that sort of thing. So we always have a way of putting a little more color in our scandals and our appointments in Illinois.
Yes, you do in Chicago. Listen, our time is out, but I can't let you get away without bringing up this one last topic. We've got really just a few seconds, Charisse, because I'm curious. Everyone is talking about Michelle Obama's wardrobe, and I'm curious from you, does this story have, pardon the expression, legs?
It's going to have legs for the next 4 years. I mean, this woman, people are fascinated by her. You know, they've never seen a black woman in this position. She's brilliant. She's professional. She's got these two little girls she's raising. And she's become a style icon. So it's got legs, but I think we'll be talking about more than that when we refer to Michelle Obama, because she brings a lot to the table.
All right. Thank you so much. Clarence Page is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington. And Charisse Jones is a national correspondent with USA Today, joining us for the first time. We're going to have you back. She joined us from NPR studios in New York. Thanks again. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Biggie, Tupac, JonBenet Ramsey, just a few of the thousands of unsolved murder cases in the United States alone. We continue now with our series on crime with a look back on some of the more notorious cases. Later on, we're going to examine why so many of us are so intrigued by murder mysteries. Joining me now is Frankie Bailey. She's Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Albany. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
There are so many types of crimes. Which ones tend to grab our attention? Isn't it murder?
Murder does grab our attention, yes, because murder, although most murders in reality are fairly garden variety, someone having a brawl in a bar type of murders, the ones that we're attracted to tend to be the sensational cases.
Now, there are literally thousands of these kinds of cases going back through history, some that have, you know, withstood the test of time. What are some of the most famous ones in the U.S.?
Well, you know, there's a very long list, and, you know, actually a colleague and I had a five-volume set on famous American crimes and trials, so I can't go over all of them. But let me just mention a few, and I want to mention one in London as well. But, for example, going back to the 19th century, the Mary Rogers case. Here in Albany, we have Jack Legs Diamond, the Prohibition gangster who was killed in Albany. We have the Elizabeth Short case.
Oh, yeah, the Black Dahlia, right? That's Black
exactly.
Dahlia.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The Lizzie Borden case. And then we get into the 20th century, and there's a whole line of cases that at the time were called the crime of the century. For example, the Harry Thaw Stanford White case. Not an unsolved case, but a very famous case. So many of the more famous cases actually did have some resolution, but there are a few that still remain unsolved for one reason or another. I mentioned Lizzie Borden, which technically did go to trial because Lizzie Borden was charged with the murders of her father and stepmother and stood trial, but she was acquitted. And so technically the case is still unsolved, as in the O.J. Simpson case in modern times.
Now, we all know about Jack the Ripper, a famous London case. Is that the most famous of the cases overseas?
Well, Jack the Ripper is really interesting. Not necessarily the most famous, but perhaps the most famous serial killer, because as some scholars have argued, he introduced the age of the modern serial killer, the modern sex killer, because he killed five prostitutes in a poor area in London, Whitechapel, in 1888. And he was very much in terms of how people were beginning to think about the dangers of the city, this idea that a killer could move through the fog, even as police hunted and searched for him, he was able to kill and disappear.
Now, we also have murder cases that are actually assassinations involving people like Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But those are of a different type, are they not?
Yeah, because even when an offender, a suspect is identified and goes to trial, there's often the suspicion that there is some untold story, some conspiracy involving the government or someone else, that some conspiracy has been covered up and people continue to believe that about many of these cases. Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X.
Now, except for Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, you don't normally hear, do you, stories of murders of African Americans becoming big, at least until Tupac and Biggie, right? Am I right about that?
Well, we do have the Atlanta child murder cases
involving Wayne Williams.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting because you do have a black man arrested and charged with those murders. But again, the suspicion on the part of some people that he was not the guilty party.
Now, why is it? Why is it that we don't have, there seems to be an imbalance in terms of really, I hate to use the word popular, but I can't think of another one at the moment, murder cases when the victims are African American?
There's a kind of interesting question there, and you know, I teach a class in race and crime, so I could talk for a long time about this. But I think the short version of that is that in terms of the cases that receive, and talking about the modern period now, in terms of the cases that receive intense media coverage, these tend to be cases that would appeal to an audience of television watchers and consumers who are going to be pushing up the ratings of television stations and newspapers that cover a case. And so the cases tend to be cases that would appeal to that audience, white, middle class, or upper class. Often the cases are not even middle class, they're upper class, and they're fairly sensational cases involving celebrities or a case involving a child, for example, cases involving innocent children, a case that the audience can identify with. Whereas with African Americans and other people of color, there is an assumption about the typical African American offender and the typical suspect, the typical victim. And since the 1960s, the assumption has been that these are inner city crimes and that somehow they don't affect a larger audience.
Does it matter whether or not, in terms of whether a crime will become one that fits into the pantheon of crimes. Does it matter whether it's the victim that the story is built around or the perpetrator of the crime?
Well, it all depends. I mean, if you have a really good villain like Jack the Ripper, for example, or Ted Bundy in the United States, Ted Bundy is an example of a villain, an offender who was appealing to many people. He was, educated, white male, handsome, charming, and that was one of the ways that he had appealed to his victims, to the women he killed. But he also continued to appeal to an audience even when he was on death row. So it all depends, I guess, is the best answer. And so there are some victims that are particularly appealing, as I mentioned, children. And we had this discussion not too many years ago about the single white female. Those cases in which a young white female was the victim tended to appeal. Some cases involving the elderly may capture the attention of the audience.
Has there been, in your estimation, a bigger black villain than O.J. Simpson in modern times?
Well, O.J. Simpson's interesting because he started out as someone that the audience, and here when I'm talking about the readers, the viewers, that people liked in the beginning. He had established a career as an actor, as a sports figure, celebrity. People liked him. But then gradually over time, as we see in some other cases, his popularity fell. And that is something that tends to happen when a media trial goes on over time. Opinions about the suspect and then later the defendant may change. But I think O.J. is interesting in the sense that he, like Lizzie Borden, was acquitted, but then later ostracized because people really thought he had gotten away with murder, in effect.
Frankie, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Frankie Bailey. She is an associate professor at the University of Albany. She's also the author of a number of crime novels, including You Should Have Died on Monday. She joined us from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. So we've looked at the history of unsolved crimes, but why are we so fascinated by it all? We turn now to Michael Mantell. He is a clinical and corporate psychologist and served as the chief psychologist for the San Diego Police Department for 10 years. Michael, welcome to News and Notes.
Good to be with you.
So let's talk about this fascination with crime and murder mysteries. That's not necessarily a modern thing either, is it?
No, of course not. I think that we have been fascinated with the conflict between good and evil since the beginning of time. Soon after the world was created, we see a conflict between two brothers, Cain and Abel. I think that there has always been this deep, deep fascination with good and evil. Since the 50s, we have been bombarded, really, in the media with accounts of crime stories, and it probably came to real fruition in the 70s, and it's taken off since then. So, you know, our fascination with crime is equaled by our fear of crime. It's two sides of the same story, actually.
You know, when you think about some of the, you know, crime novels, you know, the pulp fiction that you see people reading, and I read it also because I'm fascinated by it. What does that say about, you know, about us?
Well, I think it says that we're normal and we're healthy, and these are psychologically fine interests. The fact is, I think our interest in crime serves a number of different healthy psychological purposes. The first is a sense of not me. This feeling of I'm interested, but I'm interested because it calms me that I'm not the victim. He, she, they are the victim. And I think that's a very important element to understand.
Is this sort of a voyeurism?
Definitely psychological voyeurism.
Really? Are there certain kinds? Is there a line, perhaps, that you should cross or you should not cross in terms of what is appropriate crime to be interested in? I mean, there's brutal crime, and then there's there's simple murders with not too bloody. There's poisoning. There's stabbing. There's drowning, and then there's hacking into 1,000 pieces and eating the people that you kill. Where do you draw the line over what's appropriate and what's not?
That's a great question. I think it's not the crime content. Let's face it, the media understands if it bleeds, it leads. And probably 25% to 30% of most television news today it deals with crime, particularly personal crime and murder. Violent, predatory crimes against people go to the top of the list. And as your previous guest said, there seems to be still an overrepresentation of white female victims in TV news. I think that it's not the content, to get back to your question, it's how obsessed you are. If all you do is read about crime, and all you do, regardless of the nature of crime, and all you do is talk about it, and you have posters of it, and you have newspaper articles, clippings in your desk drawer, I'd be concerned. I'd be concerned about working with those people.
Absolutely. Listen, let me ask you to hold on, Michael. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and continue this very interesting conversation in just a couple of moments. Stand by. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back now talking about the fascination that we all have with crime, and we're talking about that with Michael Mantell. He is a clinical and corporate psychologist. Before the break, Michael, you were talking about how much we indulge in crime, and it reminded me during my days as a courthouse crime reporter, and I've covered cases all over the country, I used to run into Anne Rice, the crime novelist, all the time in the courtroom watching these crimes unfold, and she wrote some books, and some of them turned into movies. My question is, talk a little bit more about how much we should be concerned or how careful we need to be about how much we indulge ourselves in these crime stories and novels.
Well, I think it can become overwhelming, and I think it can take a life of its own. I think especially for young children, teenagers who are immersed in reading about crime, talking about crimes, play-acting out crimes, it has a double-edged sword, in a sense. On the one hand, I think it can sink kids into that and they can't come out of it. On the other, there's an element of rehearsing anxiety. When we read about crime, we're thinking about how would we handle it if we were a victim. And there's a catharsis that is actually healthy. So it's hard to draw the specific line as where it's too much, but if it's taking up more than half of your day and it's interfering with your work or school, that's too much. This catharsis element of listening to news stories about crime is reasonable and healthy. Remember, what Americans want is a tragedy with a happy ending. We want to see the closure. If I say to you, dump, da da dump, dump, you have to say,
dump, dump. Yeah.
You can't not.
That's true.
We want to see the crime, the conflict, but we want to see the resolution.
Now, you mentioned play acting. Is there any evidence to show that there is an interest in crime stories that can lead some people to actually, you know, commit crimes like copycat?
Well, of course, and this is a concern. I wrote a book on violence in the workplace a number of years ago, and whenever we see an act of violence in the workplace, there's always going to be a copycat somewhere in the country. Let me just quickly say this, though. We saw with the inauguration of our new president, Obama, an amazingly hopeful thing. More than a million people, I don't remember the exact number, stood together, and there wasn't one arrest.
That's right.
Now, that is an amazing thing. Nowhere in America did that take place except there. So we have to be thinking that his words, choose hope over fear, demonstrated with more than a million people standing together and no crime being committed, you know, is a story for the future of hopefulness. And I think that speaks to another element of why we're fascinated with crime, Tony, and that's the sense of compassion. Either you believe people are good or you believe people are bad. I believe people are good. And I think that one reason that we are interested in crime is because it allows us to feel our compassion. Not only a compassion for the victim, but sometimes compassion for the perpetrator.
Well, let me ask you this, as we have to bring our conversation to a close. Is there the danger that we are becoming desensitized to crime? Because we see it on the streets for real, on the news for real, and then we read about it and go to the movies and watch it.
No, I don't think so. Crime and conflict is an aspect of the human condition that's been with us from the beginning. It will always be with us. I don't think we're any more desensitized. I think our interest is always there and will always be there.
Last thing is this. Do you find a difference gender-wise in terms of the interest that we have in either victims or perpetrators of crime? And I know I only have, unfortunately, 30 seconds
respond. The quick answer is I do not believe there is a difference in gender. I think that the kinds of crimes that men are interested in may be different than the kind of crimes women are, and the way we express our interest, but we always have our ears, you know, bent towards the news. Our eyes are looking at it. I think it's the same for men and women.
This is a fascinating topic, and I really appreciate, Michael, your coming on. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Michael Mantell. He is a clinical and corporate psychologist who served as the chief psychologist for the San Diego Police Department for 10 years. It's the dawn of a new era in Washington. No, I'm not talking about policy and bipartisanship. I'm talking about fashion. The camera lenses and the style watchers are honing in on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue with an appetite not seen since the Kennedys. Here to talk about the hemlines and the headlines is Marielle Bobo. She's the senior fashion editor at OK Magazine. Marielle, welcome to News and Notes. Nice to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
After the Democratic National Convention in August, a blog popped up called Mrs. O. There's another one called Michelle Obama Watch. Folks are covering the fashion of the First Lady closer than many big city newspapers even cover City Hall. What is it about Michelle Obama, do you think, that seems to have captivated everyone's imagination?
I think she's just really exciting to people. She's very relatable, and she seems to have kind of a very approachable sense of style. And I think people feel that she wears pieces that they can actually afford sometimes. She does a lot of mixing of high and low. She's been known to wear J. Crew. She wore a dress from the designer White House Black Market, which was like under $200. So, I mean, she wears a lot of pieces that people can actually go out and afford. So there's a part of her that people feel is really accessible.
Let's talk let's talk about what she wore on the Inauguration Day. She wore the outfits of a couple of relatively unknown designers, one of them Jason Wu, who's only 26 years old, and Isabel Toledo. Now, they were both on the Today Show yesterday, and here's Isabel, who designed the ginger grass, I'm told that's what it's called, although it kind of looks sort of greenish-yellow to me, ensemble that Michelle wore on the inauguration proceedings. Here's Isabel.
I wanted a color that felt fresh. I wanted a color that had optimism. And I chose lace, in fact, it's wool lace, because also it's not a flat surface. It has all this depth, so I felt it had more life.
So were you surprised by those selections that she wore?
I wasn't surprised that she chose designers that weren't as well known, but I was surprised that those were the designers that she picked. I think that it's really refreshing, and it's pretty in line with what the Obamas represent, you know, as a couple, and, you know, why they won and why people love them so much. I think, you know, it says a lot. People would have expected Michelle to wear one of the big American designers like Calvin Klein or Donna Karan, Ralph Lauren, you know, kind of those big established brands.
Here's Jason Wu, for example, talking a little bit about the First Lady and his design of the ivory-colored single-strap gown that she wore to the inauguration balls.
She's tall, she's beautiful, and I wanted to design a gown that would highlight her best features. And I wanted to say something about who she is and what she, I see her as a powerful, energetic, incredible woman. And, you know, why is, you know, I wanted the gown to have a dreamlike quality.
Now, you know, Muriel, everybody seems to be talking about that particular dress, don't they?
Yeah, I think, again, it was very unexpected. A lot of people aren't familiar with Jason Wu. He's a really young designer. He's only 26. And I know she's worn a few of his pieces in the past. But, you know, this really is going to put him on the map.
From a fashion standpoint, Muriel, was that dress a fashion hit or a fashion miss?
I think it was a fashion hit. I think on television it was a little bit hard to see some of the detailing in the dress, but it really had a lot of really intricate detailing. It had some really beautiful embellishment with crystals, and there were tons of tiny little rosettes in satin that were all over the dress, and I think that the silhouette was really flattering on her. It played up her arms, which are her best assets, and I think the white was, you know, it was really pretty on camera, and I think she looked like a goddess.
What impact do you think that she is going to make, or perhaps has already made, regarding the way women dress and how they feel about their bodies, especially since Mrs. Obama doesn't have what you might call a stick figure?
Yeah, I think that Michelle really shows, you know, the average woman that, you know, it's easy to find pieces that are flattering. You know, it's just about knowing your body and knowing what works for your shape. And her use of color, I think, is really, really encouraging. A lot of women are afraid to wear color, but Michelle does a lot of fun things with color where she'll mix brights and neutrals and all kinds of things, which a lot of women wouldn't think to do normally.
And what about dressing the girls, Sasha and Malia?
Sasha and Malia, I think she does a great job with dressing them. At the inauguration, she had the girls wearing J. Crew, and it's interesting because I know the pieces were custom made. The J. Crew pieces that the girls wore, they had these coats that were in bright colors and matching dresses. And the next day, the J. Crew site had crashed because so many customers had gone online to try to purchase those pieces. So it just really shows you how much, you know, people are really paying attention to what not only Michelle is wearing, but what the whole family is wearing, including the little girls.
I'll put you on the spot a little bit. From a fashion standpoint, Michelle Obama, on a scale of 1 to 10, is a?
I'd say she is a 9. I
really?
Think I put her like 8.5, 9. You know, there's always room to grow, but I think what makes a true fashionista is not always being, you know, crazy daring and risk-taking, but I think it's really knowing what suits your body, and I think she knows what works on her.
Muriel, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Marielle Bobo. She is the senior fashion editor at OK Magazine. Patti LaBelle, that name stands alone, and so does the artistry. That's why the United Negro College Fund chose to honor the legendary singer in its 30th annual Evening of Stars. Every year, the UNCF gathers top Hollywood talent in the name of education. Together, they raise money to help more than 65,000 students attend predominantly black colleges. Patti LaBelle joins us now. Welcome, Patti.
Thank you very much.
You know, you're in good company. Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Quincy Jones, Smokey, they've all been honored with the UNCF mm-hmm. Award of Excellence. How do you feel about it, and how important is it to you?
Oh, gosh. I've been doing this for years with Lou Rawls, and when he passed, I continued to be a part of the United Negro College Fund because it's so important to me to see minority children, and you don't have to be a black child, any kind of children who can't afford to go to college. That's what they've been doing for 64 years, but televising it for 30. So when they called me to be a part of it, to be honored, I was blown away because I didn't think that I was that big.
Oh, come
to be
on.
Honored. I said, "What song do you want me to sing?" They said, "No, Missy, you're going to sit down." Anyway, I just said that I'm a part of it, and I can tell people what to do to help. You can go online to uncf.org and make a donation and get a DVD of the show.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you had some great performances in your honor.
Yeah, we had Chrisette, Michelle, Tom Joyner, Wayne Brady, Fantasia, Jennifer Hudson before her tragedy, God bless her, Yolanda Adams, Brian McKnight, Mario, Sarah Dashnow, and Hendrix of LaBelle, Kobe Bryant, and Dr. Lomax.
Now, let's talk about Nona Hendrix and Sarah Dash, your girls. They did appear for you, and you guys are back together. How did that feel?
It feels great. It was 33 years that we've been apart, and now we're back together, and it's like we never stopped.
Really not.
And we're on tour now.
You've had a very successful tour so far and a well-received CD. Do you think we're going to see more of this, more follow-up?
Yeah, you're going to see another CD.
Really? Oh, great. How soon?
Oh, yeah.
How soon?
This is our first one, but we're going to do another one. I don't know when, but I know we are.
Really? I want to ask you about the inauguration before you go, because at the end of the UNCF Evening of Stars taping, you encouraged the audience back then to pray for Barack Obama that he would win, which he did. We know you campaigned for him. Where were you on Inauguration Day, and what did that feel like for you?
I was right there in the cold with everybody else.
Were you?
Yes, sitting out there, frozen feet. But it was the best frozen feet I've ever had because of what happened in front of me. Seeing him take that oath and just seeing the people in that crowd go crazy and old people in wheelchairs who never thought they would see this, seeing their reaction and seeing the white people, their reaction, seeing America and the whole world. I know they all had the same reaction. It's about time.
Here's another quick question for you. I would mm-hmm. think, Patti, that the UNCF would really stand to be a beneficiary of having someone like Barack Obama
That's
in the
I'm
White
saying.
House.
That's what I'm saying. And this show airs the same week that this greatness happened to America. And so now people will say, okay, let us help our kids so that they know that they can say, I could become the next president.
Here's my last question. I know that you talked a little bit about Jennifer mm-hmm. Hudson, and
yeah.
she's about to make her first public performance at the Super Bowl. How's she doing?
She called me 7 times, and every time I came to the phone, she couldn't do anything but cry. She didn't talk to me.
Really?
But she reached out to me like 7 times because she sends me birthday flowers. She calls me mom. She calls me for information. So right now, I don't know how she's feeling. You know, I just know that she must be going through hell.
Do you think that performing for the Super Bowl will be a good thing for
yes,
her?
Yes, and you know what else I was hoping?
What?
That she performed for Barack for this occasion that just happened, because I knew anything like that would lift her spirits. So performing for the Super Bowl is going to be some medicine. I hope she knows how to swallow it.
Now,
because nobody knows what she's feeling. You know, I hope she knows that her mother saw the best time of her life when she got that Oscar.
Absolutely. Last thing for sure. Did
mm-hmm.
you want to perform for Obama for inauguration? We know that Aretha did, but we didn't have you that day.
No, you didn't have Patti that day because Patti wasn't asked. Aretha was asked, and I said, go, girl. She's the queen. Let her sing.
Patti, thank you so much. And again, congratulations.
Thank you, Tony. You're so sweet. I'll sing for the next one.
All righty.
Okay.
All righty, Patty.
All right, honey.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The legendary Patti LaBelle is being honored in this year's UNCF Evening of Stars. Check your local TV listings for date and time. And the CD, Back to Now, featuring the reunited LaBelle, is in stores. Yeah.